On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast presents James Bond versus Spy Movies. Welcome back to our second episode of this new series on the On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast Network. And in this episode, it's 1963. And we're going to take a look at From Russia with Love and how it squares off against Charade, or Charade, depending on where you're from.
Yes, indeed. We're going to score each of today's films on a scale of 1 to 10 in five categories. And those categories are story, hero, villain, overall spectacle, and best spy moment. And then there will be a deduction round where up to 10 points can be subtracted from the film's total for whatever we determine is the low point of the movie. And I can't think of anything. I love both these movies. Anyway, back to you, Alan.
Yeah, that one's going to be a tough one. So it's just Jared and I today. The rest of the crew have abandoned us for some reason. I don't understand it. But that means we get to geek out about two really good movies.
Spoiler. Let's talk about Bond music.
Hey, I got a bunch of CDs on the desk here. Now, I want to talk about these two movies because I think we got some interesting discussions ahead.
All right. Well, since Al and I are both here in our drip dry suits and we both have our attaché cases that have extra things in them, let's just jump in and learn a bit about today's films. And let's start with 1963's From Russia with Love.
Second James Bond thriller could be more exciting than the first.
Krylenko. So he's back. Another Bulgarian they use as a killer. Take a look. You should remember him. This man kills for pleasure.
James Bond, that notorious, amazing Dr. No secret agent is back, and half the world is out to kill him. As he pits his murderous talents against the Iron Curtain and its velvet women.
Well, I'll tell you something, Coltoni. You're one of the most beautiful girls I've ever seen.
I think my mouth is too big.
No, it's the right size. For me, that is.
From Russia with Love comes Tatiana, bait for the trap. From the four corners of the world come the men and women who play a deadly, dangerous game of espionage.
Do not be alarmed, my friend. We will make you as comfortable as possible.
Ali Kerim Bey, head of Station T, Turkey. Krasnogransky, codename Grant. Chief executioner of Spectre.
My orders are to kill you and deliver the lector. No, I do. It's my business.
M of British Secret Service. The woman called Rosa Klebb, playing a double cross.
Klebb. Romanov. The door. Romanov!
Russia with Love. They dance for him. They yearn for him. They die for him. From Zagreb to Sofia. From Venice to Istanbul. From Paris to London. Agent 007 cuts an inimitable path through the palaces and boudoirs of espionage.
James, you're hurting
me. I'll do worse than that if you don't tell me. I'm doing this under orders I know. What are they?
Even if you kill me, I can say nothing.
You cannot escape.
From Russia with Love, I don't know if you know this, Alan, it stars Sean Connery.
Never heard of him.
Robert Shaw and Daniela Bianchi. I'm sorry. And it's directed by Terrence Young. Synopsis goes a little something like this. When a gorgeous young Russian woman, Tanya, requests that James Bond, a man she supposedly fell in love with just by reading his government file, helps her defect to the West, MI6 feels compelled to accommodate this request, especially since it means getting their hands on a secret Soviet coding machine. Tanya thinks she's running a secret op for Mother Russia and Smersh, but she's actually being played by Spectre. And Spectre is looking to kill 007. Here is your trivia for this one. As usual, I try to dig a little deeper than very surface level because I know Bond people listen to this and try to find maybe a couple things maybe you didn't know. That's code for I looked at IMDb trivia until I found something I didn't know. So here we go. Alan, you know what? This is just me and you today. You can weigh in on whether or not you already knew this.
Okay. I was just going to say, we were just talking about this off air before we started recording, but God bless IMDb trivia at the time. Because total transparency, folks, I completely forgot that I was in charge of doing the trivia and the synopsis for Charade today and until about 5 minutes before we started recording. So,
hey, use your resources, man. All right, trivia item number one. Director Terrence Young disliked Daniela Bianchi's legs and used a stand-in for the scene where Bond spies on the Russian embassy through the periscope.
I did not know that, and that amazes me. That girl has a gorgeous set of pins. Who did he find that he thought had better-looking legs than her?
Yeah, that's a... When Daniela Bianchi doesn't measure up, that's... Anyway, item number two. Sir Sean Connery was outfitted for this movie with 8 specially-tailored Savile-Row suits, each one costing approximately $2,000. So in total, $16,000 worth of suits. Did I do the math for you? Yes, I did. In today's dollars, that would be almost $160,000 worth of suits. And finally, and I like this one. This one you probably did know, Alan, but I like it. Although he had his reservations about the choice of Sean Connery for the part of Bond, and that's putting it mildly, Fleming, this is about Fleming. He was not big on Sean Connery as James Bond. After seeing him in this movie, From Russia with Love, Ian Fleming was completely won over by the actor. In fact, as a result of this film, Fleming added Scottish ancestry to Bond's character in the novels.
In which novel did he add the Scottish background?
It was Nothing Less Bond Scotland. Actually, if I had to guess, I need a clue. Is it novel or is it a collection of short stories?
Novel.
Okay. Spy, you love me?
I believe it was on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
That was going to be my other guess. Damn it. That would make sense because they talk so much about heraldry in that one.
Yeah.
That's probably right.
Ah! And if I'm wrong, I'm sorry, but I think it's that one because that's also the one where he actually name checks Ursula Andress as well.
Oh.
So.
It has occurred to me that I think that's maybe the only Fleming one I haven't read. So. Okay. I know. I'll get to it, I promise.
One of the best ones.
Well, you go ahead and save me from all this and just talk about your movie.
Okay.
Your movie, our other movie.
All right, so I'll pick up. Let's have a look at today's challenger, which we've mentioned a couple of times, is Charade. Let's have a quick listen to the audio of the trailer first.
Know each other?
Why do you think we're going to?
I don't know. How would I know?
Because I already know an awful lot of people, and until one of them dies, I couldn't possibly meet anyone else.
Well, if anyone goes on the critical list, let me know.
As you can see, she was in serious trouble, but she still found time to enjoy herself.
Mrs. Lampert, any morning now, you could wake up dead.
Of course, she never had as much fun as her husband. Now, he knew how to relax. You see, it all began when he got off the train. Now there's a relaxed husband.
Police probably think I killed him.
Instant divorce, you mean?
From then on, her life was one round of enjoyment. Entertainment. Enchantment?
What are you doing in here?
I'm having a nervous breakdown.
But her life wasn't always that gay. There were times when she was in dire jeopardy.
Hasn't it occurred to you that I'm having a tough time keeping my hands off you? Oh, you should see your face.
What's the matter with it?
It's lovely.
Waterproof?
Well, you're Charles Voss's wife. Now that he's dead, you're their only lead.
Mr. Bartholomew, if you're trying to frighten me, you're doing a first-rate job.
So Charade stars Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn and was directed by Stanley Donen, not Alfred Hitchcock, which actually a lot of people think. This is generally referred to as the best Hitchcock film that Hitchcock never made, because it is a very Hitchcockian, is that a word?
Yes, it's a Hitchcockian film.
Film, yes. So I must admit, for years I thought it was a Hitchcock film. All right, synopsis. Very easy, quick and easy. Romance and suspense ensue in Paris as a woman is pursued by several men who want a fortune her murdered husband had stolen. But who can she trust? Da, da, da. All right, a few little bits of trivia. If you've seen the movie, and I hope you have, because we're going to go talk about it. So if you haven't, maybe pause the podcast here, go watch both of the movies, and then come back. Okay, if you're back. So there's a fun scene in Charade when Cary Grant basically ends up in the shower fully clothed in his drip-dry suit, as Gerard alluded to at the beginning of the show. Basically, that was because Cary Grant did not want to strip off for that scene. He was approaching 60, felt he was slightly overweight, not exactly a sex symbol anymore, so he basically decided that they would do the shower with him without keeping all his clothes on, and then they decided it was funnier that way anyway. And actually, it is one of the highlights of the film, I think. So
I agree.
Okay, the next one's a good lesson in perseverance, apparently. I did not know this, but basically the original screenplay by screenwriter Peter Stone was rejected by 7 different movie studios. So he turned it into a novel and then got it printed in Red Book magazine, if you older folks remember Red Book magazine.
I actually remember Red Book.
Yeah. So it appeared in the July 1960s, or I don't know if it was serialized or the full thing in there was a one-off story, but it certainly started to be printed in the July 1961 issue of Red Book magazine. And that, in turn, sparked the interest from all the 7 studios who'd actually previously rejected him. And it was originally entitled The Unsuspecting Wife, which is not quite as catchy as Charade, I don't think.
Does not roll off the tongue.
No. And one of the things I actually did know about this movie, but I think it's really worth talking about, is this movie is in the public domain.
For reals?
For reals, because copyright law was slightly different before 1989. And before 1989, you actually had to specifically state a copyright claim on something. You had to include the words copyright and the copyright symbol. And they did not do that when it was released.
That explains, like, I see a lot of different versions on DVD.
And yeah, if you like, oh, I want to watch this on Amazon Prime, you'll find like 4 different versions pop up on Amazon Prime, and you'll find it on different streaming services. And back in the day when we used to buy DVDs, you'll find it on a lot of the cheap DVD collections, the cheap DVD releases. Some of the prints are really horrible, you know, multi-generational prints. But yes, surprisingly, this movie due to somebody's oversight of not putting one word and a little symbol in the credits, is in the public domain.
Oh, man. I remember we had slightly similar, we covered Night of the Living Dead on Saturday Matinee Theater on the Long Box Crusade Network. And that's in the public domain as well because they changed the title at the last minute.
Yeah.
And because they changed the title, they copyright on the old title, not the new one. And so, same deal. Anyway, that's wild. That does explain why I've seen this movie in several different DVD versions. Yeah, that makes total sense. But I did want to back up to your first trivia fact.
Yeah.
Cary Grant wants to keep his clothes on because he feels like he's overweight and pushing 60. He still looks fantastic. Like if I'm 47 and I'd kill to look the way he looks.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. And if when you think about it, we're only, 1 year on from Dr. No, and he was originally approached to play Bond. Dr. No. So, and he didn't want to do it. I mean, if you like Cary Grant, you're interested in Cary Grant, this is a slight diversion, but there's a series that came out recently on streaming, and I'm trying to remember, I think it was on Hulu, called Archie. It may have been on Netflix, called Archie, which is Cary Grant's birth name. It's Archie Leach. That was his birth name.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about him in the latter years of his life. It's based on the memoirs of his third wife. But it starts around this point of view. One of the very early scenes is him actually looking at the script for Dr. No and turning it down. There is actually a scene showing him filming this movie with him and Audrey Hepburn and stuff. If you're interested in Cary Grant's career, it's him basically at the end of his life talking about that period in his life and all the stuff he went through. And I think it's Jason Isaac plays him, and he plays him like all different ages and all the way through. It's very good.
Sounds cool.
Highly recommend it. All right, I'll get off the Cary Grant soapbox.
All right, now we've got our Cary Grant soapbox put away. Let's start the discussion on today's films. Now, to remind everybody at home, we do want to set your score barometer properly. We're scoring them on a 1 to 10, and 5 is, as you might imagine, it's average. We like to say it's what you'd see on a decent made-for-TV movie if you were sitting home in the 1980s watching made-for-TV movies, which are actually surprisingly fun to go back and... Anyway, let me stick to the script. All right, so 5 is average. And that means it's time to enter Category 1. Category 1 is the story. How engaging or original is the story? Alan, let's start with From Russia With Love.
I'm basically going to reiterate what I said when we did this movie on Ranking the Bonds. Plug, by the way, if you want to go listen to that podcast. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the closest Fleming adaptations. It's full of spycraft, misdirection, plots within plots. Probably my favorite Connery movie, largely because of the great storyline. When you think about it, Cold War, honey traps, things like that were common, still are. It's a common technique. You know, sending an agent in, knowing it's a trap so they can uncover what's actually happening is a fairly reasonable strategy. It's reasonably grounded in reality, as far as a Bond movie goes. So for me, this is right up there as one of my favorite Bond movie stories. It really does catch me. Though I will say, putting it on again this week, and this is maybe over familiarity, but when I was rewatching it in prep for this, I actually did for one of the first times find my attention starting to wander and did pick up my phone and started playing with my phone. And I'm like, but I wonder if that's just over familiarity or not. Mm-hmm. But
could be.
But having said that, I'm giving it a 10. So what did you make of it, Jared?
I largely agree with you. I have been doing some prep for another show on the network for a little Rogue Agents action, and we're going to cover From Russia With Love, the audio drama by the BBC Radio. So From Russia With Love is very much various versions in my head. And so I watched the movie, I did the radio, and of course, I've read the book before. The radio version is much closer to the book, but what it reminded me of, just like you said, this sticks really closely to the book, the movie does, but it even adds the additional layer of Spectre into a story where Spectre never was. It's done so seamlessly and wonderfully. It just elevates the film a little more. It gives it an extra level of intrigue. It makes it a nice sequel to Dr. No. A lot of people, say, Bond movies don't really do sequels. They didn't do it until Craig did it. And I was like, this is kind of a sequel to Doctor No. I mean,
it is. She's Little Known Fact, because the real Quantum of Solace is the first ever sequel. It's like, no, From Russia with Love.
Yeah, Sylvia Trench is still there.
Yeah.
And they mentioned Doctor No.
They name checked her after revenge for the killing of Doctor No. Yeah, so
it is a fantastic story. And what's great about it is, this, although it's got levels and layers, it's not overly complex. It's easy to navigate along with it and just fun to watch it all unfold. So, yeah, I'm going to mark this one down as let's do a 10 on this one. This is peak Fleming to screen adaptation. And somehow I originally thought about it at 9, but when I remember that they took that Fleming storyline and then added another layer to it and it didn't bumble it at all, it's worth bump to a 10 for me.
Cool. Well, all right. Well, we're in agreement on the first one.
Yeah, we are. But now we got to talk about Charade. So let's talk about the story of Charade. What did you think?
Just brilliant. For me, this is pretty much the perfect mystery thriller with twist after twist. And it just pulls the audience along with it. I mean, when you think about it, it's a pretty straightforward plot. You know, it's a bunch of guys who, you know, did something naughty in the war. And then, you know, one of the gang turns on them and then he gets killed. And then they're after his wife because she thinks that's a secret. And it feels so multi-layered. I mean, it really grabs you from the start with the, you know, the guy getting thrown off the train, the very short pre-credit sequence. And it really doesn't let you go. And to be honest, the dialogue is just so smart, so clever, so witty, not a wasted word. And particularly the repartee between Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn. I don't know how much of that was the script, how much of that was ad-libbed, or if any, but it's wonderfully written and flawlessly delivered. Can I give this a 12 out of 10?
I mean, in your head, yes.
But now this is a 10. Equal effort from For Russia With Love, but for different reasons.
I'm going to wholeheartedly agree with you, Alan. My dad brought this home from the Fort Rucker Public Library on VHS when I was in high school. He said, I think my mom was out of town. It was just a dad and son weekend. And he's like, hey, I checked out some movies that I'm almost positive you'll like. And I can still tell you all three. He actually brought three movies home. He brought Charade. He brought Hopscotch with Walter Matthau. And he brought Kelly's Heroes. And that's
a good selection. That is
a trio of awesomeness. Yeah.
That is a good weekend movie watching.
And, you know, and I'm like, oh, you're going to watch these old movies with my dad, you know, and Mom and Van, and I watch it. And I'm like, this is incredible. Like, it's riveting. It's funny. It's got a little menace. It just grips you and holds you from beginning to end. Even love the whole, you know, M. Night Shyamalan twists before there were M. Night Shyamalan twists, you know, when they show you multiple times to your face what you're looking for. And, you know, you don't see it until the end. Uh-huh. And if you did figure it out early, like, oh, I figured it out early, I feel bad for you because it's so much fun to figure it out at the end. So, yeah, this is a phenomenal, fun film that just stands the test of time. This film is, Carrie, we don't do the math on this show, several years old. It still stands the test of time. Mark me down for 10, Alan.
Okay. To your point, though, I've watched this movie. I don't know how many times I've watched this movie. It's certainly at least once a year. Even though you know the MacGuffin, you know the thing, you know what is, mm-hmm. And as you said, it's in front of your face numerous times. It doesn't detract from it. There are some of those movies that once you know the twist and you go back and rewatch it, you're like, okay, you know. And then you start getting annoyed at the characters because they don't see it.
Yeah.
But this one, I don't know, it's still gripping all the way to the end, right up until that point where the James Coburn character is the first one to twig what's going on. And you're like, oh, okay, yeah, that's still a very cool moment. So
it is. It was funny because I was rewatching it today, actually. I had it on this morning while I was doing some work in the background. And that moment in particular, I wanted to pay attention to because I couldn't remember how much they gave away. As I remember him like stopping, realizing his surroundings and running out. But when I rewatched it, I realized they did splice in like stamps, right?
Yeah.
In that scene. And I almost wish they hadn't, because it would have looked so neat to have him do the whole, you know, I've woken up, I realized that, I take off. And
right.
Let Cary Grant be like, what just happened? And then do stamp. You know, I'm here giving directing lessons, you know, to the guy who was damn near Hitchcock, right?
Right,
so,
yeah.
But Anyways, yeah, I could go on about certain scenes, but you know, we have more categories to do.
We do indeed. So I guess our second category is how cool or memorable is the hero? This is going to be a tough one, I think. So, Sean Connery versus Cary Grant. All right. Come on, Jared. From Russia with Love, how cool is James Bond? I mean, should I just write 10?
10. Just write a 10 down. I think this is peak Bond. This is several people's favorite Bond. I think we go through this phase with our Bonds, especially those of us who are kids of the 80s, who grew up with Roger. And then you start learning about the whole series and you watch him. You go, oh, this Connery guy. Yeah, he was really it. And then you go, oh, From Russia with Love's kind of a little boring because you got used to the Roger going to space and being in an alligator submarine and, you know. And then you
like old stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And you get older and you start going like, I still say that my opinion that From Russia with Love is the most spy-y. Mm-hmm. The most espionage-y of them all.
I'd agree with that. Yeah.
It just goes to show that Sean can do bombastic Bond, which is probably for him, You Only Live Twice. It's probably, I would say maybe his most bombastic sort of volcanoes and ninjas and blah, blah, blah. And he can do this subtle, smooth, more introspective character. He looks the business. I gave you the budget on the suits. He always looks good. He's still eager to be there in the role, and it shows. He's just perfect. And all of us Bond fans out there just, I think, need to thank God they cast this guy. I think Albert R. Broccoli, Terrence Young, and Sean Connery. And I'll even throw in John Barry. If you don't get that Mount Rushmore of people to launch this franchise, it might not be what it is today.
Yeah. I have a very short note. For me, this is Connery's best performance as Bond.
And I wouldn't fight you on that.
I think you're right in terms of Dr. No was good, but you could see he was feeling his way into the role. Mm-hmm. Here he's comfortable in the role. He's still enthusiastic about it, but he's not tired. He's not jaded. He's not worn down by the role. He's not worn down by the fame. He's doing a great job as an actor, really building on what he'd done before. Again, like we talked about, this is a great sequel to Dr. No, and Connery's performance, I think, is part of that, is the growth in the character. But I think he peaked early, and I think he peaked here at his second Bond movie in terms of playing the character. Some folks may disagree, but for me, this is Connery most like the Bond that I think about when I read the books. So yeah, a definite 10 for me as well.
You know, just to throw this in, maybe get your take. I get the feeling that Connery, the man, just Sean Connery, he was kind of a man's man, kind of a rough and tumble dude.
Oh yeah, he's a macho man, yeah.
Right. I think the big step that what I'm getting at here is from Dr. No to From Rush with Love, is I think in Dr. No, he had to get coached on how to get comfortable being smooth, sophisticated, classy, high end. He kind of had to get coached on that in Dr. No. And I think he kind of really found the balance in From Russia with Love. Like, I think he got comfortable with fanciness and high end stuff by the time he gets to From Russia with Love. And I think that's what we're seeing. I think he's more comfortably smooth, but still retains a bit of that ruggedness. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, he does. And he still has that sense of danger. And underlying violence and stuff, even though he's comfortable in the expensive suits. And
exactly.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And he knows what wine to eat, have with your fish. So.
That's right. We all know that.
I would never have gone out to dinner with Sean Connery because I only ever drink red wine, so it'd probably hit me evening.
to this day, that was like my education on wine. So in my head, it's always like red wine with beef, white wine with fish. And I don't know if that's a real thing or not. That's what I learned from this movie, and it's stuck in my head for life. Oh, goodness.
So I did learn there actually is a white, or there was a white Chianti. They stopped making it years ago. So, all right. So, yeah, 10 and 10. So let's move on to charade. Cary Grant.
Man, Cary Grant complaining that he doesn't think he looks good enough. He still looks fantastic. To me, this is the definitive performance.
Sorry, I was just going to say, we got into the actors there. Really, we should be rating the character. And of course, James Bond is a 10, but it's Cary Grant. And I'm not going to give a name to his character because I think that's part of what we want to talk about.
He's got, yes, Cary Grant and the multiple different characters that he plays. Now, it's not, If listeners, if you didn't go ahead and watch this movie, it's not like, Eddie Murphy playing a variety of different characters. He's the same guy. He just, how do I explain this? He just keeps changing names and pseudonyms and he's lying about who he is a lot to the movie. And that's all I'll give you. What was I going to say? To me, this is the definitive Cary Grant portrayal. He might have been in tons of other amazing movies, some of which I've seen, some of which I may not have. This is how I was introduced to this guy. And of course, when you grow up, even when you're a teenager like I was when I was introduced to this movie, you can't not know who he is. You've heard people reference Cary Grant. Oh, this guy thinks he's Cary Grant. So you know, okay, he's handsome and charming, and I get that. And then you see it. Then you realize this is the dude's career as it's winding down. And you're just like, dang, you know? I've seen him in Gunga Din, which was like 1930-something film where he's very young. He just never loses a step. And so his performance as, I'm just going to say, Crookshank, as Crookshank, is just a joy to watch. It's an absolute joy to watch. He's just fun, engaging, and I don't know how else to say it. It's just a joy to watch.
Yep, definitely is. Definitely is.
Is his character a 10 to the level of the smoothest James Bond performance? I don't know. Let me mull that over and you give me your thoughts, Al.
Okay, I'll give you my thoughts. I was going to say why you figure out a score. So I'm going to preface this by saying that Cary Grant is a god in this house. He's born in the same city as Jill. He's a huge Cary Grant fan. We have multiple Cary Grant biographies, Cary Grant posters. He can do no wrong in this household. I will say, I think he was the coolest man ever to walk the planet. Totally with Jill on that one. Very, very cool man. Flawed, sure, like Connery was flawed on his personal life. But in this, I don't think it's his pinnacle of his performances. I think that's North by Northwest.
That's fair. I didn't think of it, which is actually Hitchcock, by the way.
Which actually is his. Well, yeah, and To Catch a Thief, which is another one of his Hitchcock ones.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, that was a good one too.
Yeah. But in this, what I love in this is the way that his hero, no matter what name he's using, switches smoothly from identity to identity without hesitation. And every time he gets called out on it, he's already got another plausible backstory. It's like, oh, well, no, I'm not that guy. I'm his brother. Well, no, I'm this other person. And I'm doing this because of X, or I'm doing it because of Y. And you never really find out who he is until right at the very end. And even then, it's like, is he still? It's never really resolved. Is he really who he says he is at the end? I mean, there's clues that suggest he may be, but because he's been so comfortable all the way through it. And I love the fact he's comfortable romance, doing the romance very slowly. You know, he's even rejecting her advances. Mm-hmm. He's great being funny. This character is fine undercover with the bad guys. You know, he'll face down their threats. He can get physical with the rooftop fights, the chase through the streets of Paris. I mean, he's a player right until the end. This is a really magnificent performance. Again, I don't think it's necessarily his best, but as a character, as a hero, I think it's fascinating because you're never sure if he is the hero. And that's actually one of the notes I had. Who is the hero of this movie? Is it him? Or is it Audrey Hepburn's character, Regina Lampert, the wife, who goes from like completely blindsided and confused to find out that her husband has basically left her destitute. And then all these weird characters enter her life threatening to kill her. And she gradually starts, she has her own agency and she gets, proactive skills. And she calls out Cary Grant's character two or three times as she finds out he's lying and stuff. So I'm going to say, how memorable is the hero? 10. But I'm going to say, if I could, that'd be like a 10 for each of them, because I think there's two heroes in this movie. I think it's Cary Grant's character, whatever name you want to pick, and Audrey Hepburn's Regina Lampert, I thought was a really smart, tough heroine. Could have easily just been somebody who screamed. And I know she did scream and stuff a couple of times, but I felt that was earned. You know, with her feeling like she was going through a mental breakdown because there's all this weird stuff happening around her. And then she sort of gets into it and starts poking at things and being proactive. So, I thought they were both brilliant. And I'd say there was two heroes in this movie. So whether it's 5-5 or whatever, I think I'm just going to give it 10 for both of them.
And that's fair enough. Yeah, she was quite good in handling a lot of curveballs.
Yes.
And as you mentioned before, we talk story too, just the dialogue and how they deliver lines tells so much. Like, she's trying to deal with all that. He offers her liverwurst and chicken. She's like, no, I'm not hungry. And he drops like all this big news on her. She's like, Can I have a sandwich, please? Which one? Take the chicken.
I love the running gag that whenever she was stressed, she would stress eat.
Yeah. You've only eaten five times today.
Yeah.
Oh, great. It was great, great. Hey, this is tough. I don't want to be barred from the Porter household. And you may be right. Cary Grant's best performance might be North by Northwest or To Catch a Thief. I still find this to be the most entertaining movie, I think, of Cary Grant's that I've ever seen. I will give him a 9, a very solid 9. I like him quite a bit, but my Connery perfection bias precludes me from saying that he's as good as like peak Connery.
All right. I like
it. Don't tell Jill.
Okay, I will.
It's like if we did halvesies on this show, which I guess we could because we're not technically on the long box, but...
Yeah, but that would mess up my Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, I don't want to mess up your spreadsheet. And keeping Alan's spreadsheet nice and clean, let's go to Category 3. Category 3 is the villain. How menacing or entertaining is your villain? How memorable is your villain? Alan, you can speak to the villainy. There's a little bit of villainy going on in From Russia with Love.
One of my issues with From Russia with Love, as much as I really like it, and I think it's one of my favorite, you know, it's definitely a top 5 Bond movie for me, is who is the villain here? Is it Rosa Klebb? Is it Kronstein? Is it Blofeld? Is it Red Grant?
I choose all the above.
Yeah. I actually think, for me, the villain is actually the mysterious number one of Spectre, who isn't named at this point, because he's the one who puts everything, he hires Kronstein to basically put stuff together. And I think that little Siamese fighting fish metaphor that he uses is a great way to introduce him. It's a great way to talk about how Spectre works. And everything else that happens comes out of that, I think. I thought Rosa Klebb was creepy enough, but it's very toned down from the book.
Yep. And the radio play.
And the radio play. She's still creepy and ruthless, but she's not as creepy as she is in the book. You know, my first thought was, well, Grant, because of the iconic fight. But actually, when I thought about Grant, he's sloppy. He's overconfident. Bond tricks him relatively easily that leads into the fight. You know, he had Bond dead to rights on the train, and he got greedy and he got sloppy. Grant comes across to me more of like a glorified thug among a group of thinkers. He doesn't really think like everybody else.
I put him firmly in the henchman category.
Yeah.
Jaws, an odd job. I think he's a top tier.
Yeah.
But I agree.
He's not the villain. So I think because of that confusion, that lack of focus, I gave the villain or villains or the group of villains an 8.
Yeah, I don't think I would fight you on that. To me, we're in lockstep once again. When I think From Russia with Love, I think it lacks a powerful punch villain because it's a little spread out. I mean, I love Red Grant and Rosa Klebb is cool. And of course, you've got the unnamed number one and Kronstein.
See, and I even forgot Maunsey, the guy who goes on to play General Gogol.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's right.
Who's running the Spectre training camp and the boats and stuff. So,
That guy obviously moved up the ranks.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think getting an 8 from you is pretty lofty considering there's not like a Scaramanga or a, you know, a boom villain in your face. This is the villain, villain type of deal. So I'll join you. I'll join you on an 8, which is actually kind of a high compliment to a film that's villainy is quite spread out.
Yep. Which I guess brings us to the villains in Charade.
Oh my.
What a great ensemble of villains. I always remember these guys. I mean, you got James Coburn. I mean, the guy's screen presence just, in this, just, you know, the minute he walks through that door at the funeral, it's like, oh my God, we're in for something good here. Even if his text is a bit stereotyped. Yeah, always a powerful screen presence, quite menacing. But for me, George Kennedy as the guy with the arm, utterly frightening as a psychotic Scobie. I think his screen presence is even more. He's just, I think this is one of his best performances. He's just downright scary. Even when he's talking to the other guys in his gang, you never know if he's going to go off on one of them or whatever. And then Walter Matthau was just calm and smooth as the villain hidden in plain sight. I mean, how cool was that? It turns out to be the manipulative planner who turns out to be really the biggest villain of them all. I thought it was great. I think the villains were only let down by the little sneezing character, Leopold, who was played by an actor called Ned Glass. To me, it didn't come across as frightening as I think he was meant to be. And when I think about this movie, I always forget about him. The others I can instantly recall. Of the four of them, I think it was going to be a little bit of comic relief, evil comic relief. I don't know. It just didn't work with the other three, I don't think.
The thing I remember most about him is James Coburn saying, he's even meaner than I am, you know? Yeah, yeah. Which does make him a little scary because he seems mild and goofy and bookwormish and all that. But you get the feeling like if any of them enjoy torturing people, it's him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. But I think it takes Coburn saying that.
Yes, that's what's given it the gravitas. Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't come over in the performance or the way the character's written. So because of Sneezing Leopold, they get a 9 out of 10 for me.
A lot of times on Action Film Face-Off, which is another podcast my brother and I do, very similar in format to this one, we talk about when you get not necessarily a villain, but a group of villains or villainy, as we sometimes would call it. One of two things usually happens. They usually build upon each other to get a high score. They're sort of the sum of the parts. And then sometimes they kind of average each other out. From Rush With Love, they do some building and some averaging. And in this one, it feels like a lot of building. It's like everyone is a building block. The weakest one probably being Leopold, but he still has his place. Casting Walter Matthau as a villain is just great because he's so likable.
Mm-hmm.
He's so very likable. I don't know if you ever saw the remake of this film, or The Truth About Charlie.
Yeah, I think I did. I can't say
it was okay, but if you're familiar with the original, it's just watch the original, you know. But in Truth About Charlie, he was played by Tim Robbins, another very sort of genial, unassuming, you wouldn't think of him as the villain kind of guy. So at least I got that casting right. So my point is just really good for a movie that's all about misdirection. Great casting in that you get George Kennedy being so menacing and Coburn and that all that going on. And you got this super likable Walter Matthau there. He's doing squats in one scene, just keeping up with his health and all this stuff. So likable. And that's part of the brilliance of the movie. I will give them also a 9 for very strong villainy. And I want to point out, since we were high on the George Kennedy thing, my teenage son loves the Naked Gun movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we were watching a Naked Gun the other night. And George Kennedy, of course, in all those movies. And I pointed out to him, I said, hey, I bet you didn't know he has an Academy Award. He has acting chops. He did win Best Supporting Actor for Cool Hand Luke. That's on display here, too. He's so scary.
Yeah.
So very cool.
I didn't actually put this in the trivia, but there's actually 4 Oscar winners in this movie, and Cary Grant isn't one of them.
I just assumed he would be. He didn't win an Oscar?
He only ever got an honorary Oscar. He never got an acting Oscar.
Oh, wow. So who are the 4? Let's hit this. Well, clearly, George. Audrey Hepburn.
Coburn,
more than likely. I couldn't say what for, but probably some
Walter Matthau.
Oh, Walter. Always unassuming, Walter Matthau.
Yeah. I may be wrong on Coburn, but anyway, yeah.
I'm willing to believe you.
Yeah.
All right. That should wrap it up for round 3. I'll pass it to you for category 4.
So category 4 is overall spectacle. How visually engaging is the film overall? Stunts, effects, cinematography. And I'd also throw the music in there as well. How would you rate From Russia With Love as a spectacle?
Oh, man. Now, I talked earlier about how it's not the most bombastic Bond. It requires a bit more patience. You know, if you're a 9-year-old watching James Bond for the first time, Roger Moore is going to need to be your wheelhouse. And I'm not picking on people who are well over 9 and love Roger Moore. I love him too. But you see what I'm saying? It requires a bit more patience to stay in From Russia With Love. You were checking your phone. You admitted it, but that's probably from familiarity. So as far as spectacle goes, overall, its engagement factor, you have to pay attention a little more hardly, if that makes sense, than you do for other films. Now, there's a lot to like as far as spectacle. We talked about music. This is John Barry being amazing. And there's so much more good John Barry to come that you should probably listen to the podcast Al and I did called 6 of the Best. And the series that we did with Raymond. Bond Music 101. That's where we covered the majority of early Barry. So music's on point. We talked about the wardrobe. I would put wardrobe as part of spectacle as well. It's fantastic. Sets and locations, pretty good. We haven't seen the height of the Ken Adam powers yet, but it's coming. And I would say as far as sort of action and eye-popping adventure going, it's got that train fight that will more than likely come up in favorite spy moments later on in the show. It's got that train fight. It's got the boat chase and the helicopter thing. A lot of stuff that happens in the second half. Gypsy Camp fight's not bad, but not the strongest spectacle Bond film, but still a fun one. I'll let you take it from there.
You going to score it or are you going to wait?
Now, the trick is, am I doing it between these two movies or am I putting it in the world of Bond? I don't know. I'm comfortable at a 7 either way.
Okay. This is a difficult one. She said it's not like the spectacle we sort of come to expect from a Bond movie, but I'm trying not to think about what we've got coming. Mark it on its own. I mean, Turkey is the perfect location, I think, for a bit of East-West intrigue.
True.
Good location. So I think it was a perfect backdrop. The Orient Express stuff is fun, too, the train. I have a problem with the boat chase and the lake scene and the helicopter. I mean, the helicopter stunt is okay, but, and maybe, again, this is familiarity, but that is clearly Scotland to me, which is where it was filmed. It's a Scottish landscape, and I can't sort of get my head past that. I never really have. And then the geography of them getting from wherever they were on the coast of Turkey in a little boat to Venice and stuff, again, I don't know, seems a bit questionable. I know it's the time. Even for the time, I think the back projection on this movie was very crude, particularly at the end of the movie. I mean, they clearly never, ever went to Venice for that last scene. So it's got a lot of stuff that pulls it down for me in terms of it being visually engaging. The John Barry score brings it back up, particularly the intro of my favorite Bond cue of all time, the 007 theme.
Yes, yes.
So for that reason, I'm giving it an 8. John Barry rescues it from being a 7 and gets it up to an 8.
I also love the music he does for the train traveling.
Yeah,
I really like that as well, too. I want to give a shout out to that. And while we're giving shouts out to Spectacle, I saw this in my fun facts research and I just had to bring it up somewhere. So it's going to be here. This is the movie where while they were filming it, they had the plane crash or a helicopter crash.
Yes.
Terrence Young himself was trapped.
Yeah. Underwater.
In an air bubble in a sinking helicopter. And they got him out. And I think he'd broken his arm and he went back to filming same day.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I almost drowned and broke my arm and it was a helicopter crash. Rolling.
Yeah.
That's a man that gets the job done right there.
Yeah.
That's impressive. Has nothing to do with Spectacle, though. I just want to throw that in there.
How do you feel about the Spectacle in Charade?
Whew. You don't take your eyes off it. It's an almost 2-hour movie that just keeps you going through story beats, good editing. Once again, music. I think this was a Mancini.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yep.
I'll always associate that little Charade theme with the dun, 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 the rapid fire percussion and the swirling arrows of the opening credits, which could be a home in a Bond film, really.
Well, they are Morris Binder credits.
Is it Morris Binder? Oh, there you go. I knew it felt familiar. So you've got that going for it. Good music, good editing, brisk story, great performances that keep you along the way. Now, is there anything big or bombastic as far as explosions or gunshots? Not really. There's a couple gunshots, I think, near the end. But it's really all told through story. Like, that's the grip of it, is the story and the performances and the beats that just keep coming along. I mean, even the rooftop fight's pretty good and all. I particularly love the way it ends, which is George Kennedy's dangling from the side of the building and Cary Grant just leaves. Doesn't try to save him, doesn't try to kill him. He's like, yeah, I'm out of here. That kind of perfectly encompasses what I'm trying to say about this movie as far as spectacle. There's a lot of tension, and then there's a fight, and then there's sort of an unexpected beat, and that's what keeps you in the movie the whole way. So it's spectacle by way of story and execution more than anything, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah, I'd go with that. Do you want to give it a score?
Whew, this is a tough one, too. Because, again, it's not bombastic stunts or anything, but really well done on the story and the music. I will say this is an 8 for me, which is amazing given that there's no big train fight or anything.
All right. So I think you're right. I did not pick up my phone watching this movie, even though I've watched it a gazillion times. I was, again, hooked completely. And I think, yes, that story, but I think it's actually the way that they play the story out. I mean, it's clearly set in Paris. You get the feel of the city. Get the feeling of being in the city, but they don't bash you over the head with, hey, this is Paris. Like any movie that's set in Paris that doesn't show the Eiffel Tower gets a big plus for me. If you've been lucky enough to go to Paris, it's very recognizable Paris. You know, even the bit with the The automatic gate that shuts on the metro when the train comes into the platform. Yeah, you know, it's like, oh, I remember that. Yeah. They made it into a plot element. I mean, they use the city. They use the spectacle of the city. They use the way the city's constructed as part of the plot. I think that's great. I love the cinematography, particularly the latter half of the movie. That foot chase through the metro, beautifully filmed. It feels frantic, but it feels claustrophobic. And it feels, you know, and then the standoff among the columns, the way they use the shadows and the black and white and the street lights, I thought was really very clever. I thought it was really done, well done. Good sound design too. I don't know if you picked it up, but when they were on the boat cruise every time they went under a bridge, their voices echoed. And when they came out from under the bridge, they went back to normal, like right on beat. I mean, there was no lag or anything. Very small thing, but very clever. Very clever. And you mentioned it, the Henry Mancini score. It's not quite a John Barry, but I think it's up there in terms of spy movie scores. It gets a lot of play on our turntable. I think we have two copies of this soundtrack. If I remember right, you tried to send me a third at one point.
I did. And I ended up sending it to our fellow Bond podcaster, Van Allen Plexico. And he was like, oh, this is cool. I've never seen this movie. And I was like, dude.
Really?
Okay. Stop what you're doing. I don't care whatever it is you're doing.
Go watch this movie. Yeah. So, yeah, a lot going for it. So this one got a 9 for me for spectacle. Even though, as you said, it's not what you think of as a spectacular movie.
Mm-hmm.
But what they do and the way they've woven it with the story and the location, and a lot of it was filmed on location, I think it really, really works.
I can see why my dad picked this one and Hopscotch. They have a DNA like that, and they both have Bond Dermatha.
Kelly's Heroes doesn't quite fit, but it's
still good. But it's still great. I think they went through France at some point. Well, that should take us into Category 5. Category 5 is the best spy moment. What's your favorite moment for Connery? Well, if it includes Connery, I assume it does. And From Russia with Love, Alan?
It is not the train fight.
Well, this is Alan's last episode. How could it be anything but the train fight, Alan? You gotta tell me.
That's a great action moment, and it's a great fight scene. But for me, if you're talking spy moment, for me, it's actually the boat trip on the underground reservoir with Corinne Bay in terms of them being spies, doing their job. You know, the covert thing of having the hidden door and the track down to the boat, and then him saying, you know, oh, this is my 11 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. This is what I go do, go spy on the Russians. And the fact that they worked with the city engineers and the Royal Navy to get a periscope installed that actually goes right up into the Russian briefing room. Just the whole setup of that and the way that it was thought out, the way that they used, Corinne Bay used his connections, but actually they also used the, you know, the ancient reservoir that's been there literally for centuries, but they use it, if you like, as a weapon against the Russians. I just loved that moment. I thought that was like top of the line spycraft. It showed that, you know, yes, it can be routine, but also using the assets that are there, the reservoir, using their connections in the city hall and the Royal Navy, being innovative, smuggling in a submarine periscope, and then being able to recognize who the people are in the conference room. Yeah, I just love that whole scene. I think it's a really great piece of espionage theater. So I gave that a 9 out of 10.
Well, let me just be an absolute American about this and say, train fist fight! Meow, 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 meow! Now, I love it for a lot of different reasons. Probably the main one is, you know, I can't speak to all the films of 1963 or 2. What episode is this? 63.
You were right first time.
I can't speak for any of the films of the 60s. There's a better way to go where my point is leading me. But I'm told, and I'm prepared to believe, because I've seen a lot of these other films, this kind of changed the landscape of action movie fistfights. This is very brutal. Like, there are very few movies that had fistfights this brutal and up close and personal and cramped like this. I have to believe them because it's a fistfight that you can watch today after having seen John Wick and Jackie Chan and still be like, oh, this is a good fight. This is a good film fight. It's riveting. A lot of it has to do with the actors not wanting to use stunt people. It's almost all Sean and Shaw. And that's impressive. And then you get to bring in a bit of spycraft with it because it starts with the attaché case, right? It's the first like time that a Q gadget's like going to bail him out, right? And we all know that Q gadgets range from pretty realistic attaché case to you pick it from probably the Brosnan era. I don't know. Pick something crazy, right? And this one is so cool. It's got the knife. It's got the gas. And then on the flip side, Red Grant's got the garrote in the watch. And so it's a lot of cool little spy things that make you go, ooh, it's a James Bond movie. And a lot of that, just a brutal fisticuffs that, like I said, still holds up today. It's a scene that is just kind of burned into my brain and yet riveting every time I watch it. I think it's amazing that we've had 25 Bond movies, 26 if we count Never Say Never Again. We don't do the math on this show. And this fist fight still is a top tier fist fight in the franchise. That's incredible.
Yeah, I don't disagree with a single word of that. And for me, it's not a spy moment, but I totally
I tried to sneak it in with the attaché case and the garrote thing. I have to look at this movie, and that's so standout. So I'm absolutely giving it a 10. For the second film of this long-standing, amazing franchise, to have a fist fight that's, I'm not going to do the math once again in my head, but I guarantee you it's going to be in top five fist fights in Bond history. And that's impressive. Well, I guess that leaves it up to you.
I don't know if my spy moment in Charade is a spy moment, but it's the one scene that I always remember from this movie. It's the funeral scene that introduces the three main villains.
It's great.
And I love it from the spy point of view because each of them has a different way to test whether their former colleague is actually dead. They all use different bits of spy craft to ascertain whether the guy is faking it or not, whether he is actually dead. Sneezing over the body to see if he reacts, you know, James Coburn getting the mirror out, putting it under his nose to see if it fogs the mirror. And then, you know, George Kennedy getting a pin out and just, wow, stabbing him with a pin to see if he, all great stuff. But it also sets them up as individuals. It shows different aspects of spycraft and deepens the mystery of who these three guys are and what's their involvement with the dead husband. But actually also sets up their characters as well as the spycraft. So again, is it a spy moment? I don't know. Again, to your point about the train thing, it does have moments of spycraft in it. But I think it's a brilliantly set up character moment that actually starts and deepens the mystery as to what's going on, all in one very short scene. I remembered it being a lot longer, this scene, in my head than doing the rewatch. It was like, oh, actually, that was really relatively quick. But it does such a lot. So I'm counting that as my favorite spy moment. And I'm going to give it a 10 because it does so much in such a short time.
I like that. I like it a lot because that's definitely a memorable scene for me as well. And I do love the fact that each test of the dead body is a character trait reveal for each of the villains. That's good. And of course, the French police dude, who is hilarious, by the way, sitting in the back row clipping his nails.
Yeah.
There's so many great characters. You almost forget about him. He's great too. If I was you, I'd stay out of my pajamas. So, oh man, this movie is so tough to pick. You would think I would have picked one out having watched it this morning. It almost flows so seamlessly that there's not all the moments are good, is what I'm trying to say. All the moments are good. For the sake of variety, because it'd be very easy for me to pick the funeral scene as well, I'll use the climactic chase. You mentioned it earlier, how two different directors could film a guy chasing a girl down the subway and to a location, and then there's a big, everything comes to a head with pistol shootout and whatever. And two different directors, one could make that seem fairly, you know, typical and banal, but this one just feels elevated. I think a lot of it has to do with the music from Henry Mancini. And it just, everything comes together. It's where the whole movie comes together. And it's, I'm totally cheating on both these movies by basically picking the big climax moments. But if I can't have the funeral scene, I'm going with the...
You can have the funeral scene.
I guess what I'm trying to say is I like almost every moment in this movie equally. And I think they're all great. And I would put it at an 8.
Okay. I would say, I think you said about it, this just flows so seamlessly. There's no set pieces in this movie. There's nothing where you're like, oh, they're leading up to do this big thing.
Yeah.
Like, everything is story driven.
And it's all sort of in one location. So it's not like you say, this is the train scene and this is the boat scene and this is the secret underwater river reservoir scene. Like, it's all like there at the hotel. You know, for the most part, they didn't spend a lot of money on locations.
Cool. So I guess that brings us round to our deduction round. So do you want to take any points off for anything that you think was ridiculous, over the top, unnecessary from either of these movies?
I'm sitting here racking my brain. I'm not good at this because I enjoy these movies so much. Was there anything that bugged me, bothered me? I'm not going to take any points off, but I will mention Carson Dial takes 5 bullets on the battlefield, right? And he's mad because they left him there. And there may be a reason for this, but I was like, how are you going to take 5 bullets and get left there? Like, you would make a lot of noise. Like, they would know. But then I think, well, he could have passed out. Or was there some sort of hint that they left him there on purpose?
That's what I thought of, yeah.
Like, I don't know. Because, I mean, clearly he wants the money. But did he stand up to them at the time and say, we shouldn't steal this money? So they're like, too bad he died on the battlefield. And then he felt screwed, and that's why he wanted revenge?
Or it was like he got shot and he's wounded, and it's like, well, hang on a minute, now we only have to split this 4 instead of 5.
Yeah, exactly.
So he could have been screaming his head off, and they were like, "But
he'll be okay." Yeah. You know, so...
Well, he's going to die anyway, just, yeah, so we only need to split it 4 ways. That's the way I took it.
Yeah, there's so many ways that makes sense that I'm not going to take a point off it. It just kind of made me think about it. But other than that, nothing really sticks in my mind about it bothering me.
Well, I am not taking anything from either of these two movies either, because I think in terms of what they both do, they're pretty much perfect. So, yeah.
All right. Now, don't you worry if you haven't been keeping up with the math at home, folks. We do that for you because we have reached the end of all of our rounds and we've done some math. And looking at the judges' scorecards, the winner of this episode of James Bond versus Spy Movies with a score of 92-90 is Charade. Ooh, wow.
Well, that proved us wrong when we started this show, because it was like, well, what's the point of, was it your wife or somebody said, what's the point of doing this? Because Bond's going to win every one. So we're 2 shows in and he didn't. So
I think Bond was really just a strong villain away from winning this. I think the villainy really.
Yeah.
Just, I don't say drag it down because it's still good, but it was no Max Zorin.
I think that and the fact that, again, the spectacle, if you like, wasn't quite there yet. You know, I think they tried to do the, like with Dr. No, it was like everything was in Jamaica and it felt all together. Like Charade, everything was in Paris, pretty much apart from the opening scene, and it felt all together. I think this one, they tried to do the travelogue thing, but they hadn't quite figured out how to do that yet. And it came across a bit disjointed, I think.
Yeah, I'm very comfortable with what I'm about to say. I like From Russia with Love better than Charade, but I think Charade is a better made movie. That makes sense.
Yeah,
I think it's the better film overall.
Yeah, I think it's a much better film, and I think it's a much better told and scripted. I mean, the script in Charade, I think, is way ahead of the script in From Russia with Love. I'll probably get letters.
I mean, but it's kind of the same thing as saying, what's your favorite Bond and who do you think the best Bond is?
It is.
You
know, yeah.
You're splitting those hairs. And yeah, I can say that I personally like From Russia with Love better because of my Bond DNA, but Charade's just so well made. So,
it is.
So well done.
It is. And Jill will be happy. I'll probably get fed tonight.
Yeah, that's the key. We got to keep Jill happy.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us for the second episode of James Bond versus Spy Movies. And be sure to join us next episode where we move to 1964. And it is a definite spy versus spy, as James Bond will take on Napoleon Solo as we track how well Goldfinger ranks against the Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie to trap a spy. Until then, I'm Alan Porter, and you can find me on social media for Bond stuff at Bond Lexicon on Twitter, and you can find me at James Bond Lexicon on Instagram and Tumblr, and of course, there is the jamesbondlexicon.online website companion to our James Bond Lexicon book. And if you are interested, we also have a bi-weekly James Bond newsletter, which you can get at bondlexicon.substack.com. And Jared, where can folks find you?
You can find me, Jared Albrecht, the Yard Sale Artist, at Yard Sale Artist on X and Facebook and Instagram. You can check out my artwares at www.theyardsaleartist.com, where I do offer James Bond book page sketches and Man from U.N.C.L.E. book page sketches. Plug, plug, pluggity plug. And of course, we'd appreciate if you subscribe to Honor Majesty's Secret Podcast, and we would love to hear from you. Leave us a rating or review on whatever platform you're listening to this on. We just appreciate the feedback. And if you want to be a little more direct, we are at OHMSPod on X. And as I mentioned before, if you like this format and you want to broaden it out from spy movies to action films, well, check out Action Film Face Off. It's a podcast that me and my brother do on the Longbox Crusade Network. We've been doing it for over 5 years now, and we pretty much pilfered the format of it for this show. So if you like this, you might like that. Thanks for tuning in. We appreciate you listening. And until next episode, keep your scuba suit wet
and your martini dry. I just noticed a typo in my notes, actually, that says that this is one of the closet Fleming adaptations. I think I meant closest, not closet Fleming adaptations.
Either way, it's interesting.